Well, I tell you what, public support of professional sports, it's been a big political topic this year, and we're going to spend some time talking about it. Here to help is Phil Nuccio of St. Paul.
As construction on the $130 million hockey arena gets underway in St. Paul, the Twins played baseball in the same old Metrodome this summer. And that's fine with Phil Nuccio, a St. Paul insurance investigator who once owned the small silk screening business. He sold the company partly because his taxes were too high.
This business is 9 months. However, we have a 12-month year. In that particular time, if we don't set aside money for our downtime, we're basically out of business after a year. If an owner of a sports team doesn't keep his business in line, then he goes to the taxpayer and says, you know, I can't make it. Build me a stadium where I can get more revenue for advertising, and I can have more special boxes that I can sell to high-priced people. I don't have the ability to do that.
The Twins organization says it's lost millions of dollars since 1995 and had threatened to leave town if taxpayers didn't fund a new ballpark. Citizens overwhelmingly rejected public funding for the new stadium.
This is less than 20 years old, but just because it gets a little bit older doesn't mean that it's a bad place to be.
Yet somehow the deal won't die.
Hi, I'm Phil Nuccio. I'm from Inver Grove Heights, just south of St. Paul. It's apparent that the citizens of the state of Minnesota don't want tax dollars used for the new Twin Stadium, Viking Stadium, and so on and so forth. Mr. Humphrey, your running mate, Mr. Moe, has jumped on board of the Twins Stadium deal. Mr. Coleman, you bought into the Minnesota Wild and fortified a stadium there and brought tax dollars from the state into that program. And Jesse, the other day you made a statement that you thought that the bailout of the Target Center was a good deal because it was a good deal for the citizens. And I understand that you do like basketball. My question to you gentlemen is that because of the demand now of the Minnesota Twins and soon to be the demand of the Minnesota Vikings, or they'll move to Austin, Texas, how will you as governor justify the fact, if you do bet a stadium buyout or replacement, how do you justify that to the guy in Black Duck with three kids? It's going to cost $420 million for a Twin Stadium. It's $100 a piece out of his family. How do you justify it?
I think the way you justify it to the guy in Black Duck, Minnesota, is you work out something with the guy in Black Duck, Minnesota, says that makes sense. You do it by user fees. People that are going to benefit from, who want to use it, they can pay for it. You do it by working with the local community, and if they want, they can put something on the table. They'll get involved in making it happen. It doesn't have to be. You don't stuff anything down a taxpayer's throat. But you do accept responsibility for trying to keep community assets to generate economic activity, and you can do it again. There are user fees is a clear example that people who benefit from use it. And if you don't want to use it, you don't need to get involved. But clearly, we should I think responsibility leadership is to try to figure out a way to preserve these economic assets.
What's a user fee, real quick?
User fee may be cost of hot dogs. It may be personal seat licenses. They do that in some stadiums. If you want a seat there, you actually pay for it.
Is that enough to pay for a stadium, though?
Pardon me?
Is that enough to pay for a stadium?
Well, what you also got to do is you got to get a team involved. You get the local unit of government involved. If Minneapolis wants it to happen, the local community, let me just say this, with hockey as an example, backed by a city council, backed by the Chamber of Commerce, backed by the community, ran for re-election because the community wanted it, and for them it made economic sense.
Backed by a mayor that walks up to the Capitol and asks, give me the money, give me $65 million, not loan it, not under the threat of veto from his friend Governor Carlson, not loan it, but give it to me. That's what his lieutenant governor and Governor Carlson and our mayor wanted to do during that period of time. User fee, easy answer. It's a tax. Last time I went to the Twins, I paid more for the hot dogs and the rest than it actually was for the ticket. The answer for Black Duck is simple. Who's driving this question? It's a low priority. No taxes for a stadium. None. Zero. The people have spoken abundantly clear on that. The fact is, what we're going to see on Sunday is we're going to see a stadium filled up. Take a look at what the Vikings have done. They're jammed full. Why? Because they're a great team that serves the people, and people are paying for it.
No taxes. All right.
I say no taxes, too, when he brought up the Target Center. You got to have some public buildings. You know, you got to own them if the deal's right. And the deal difference between the Target Center and the hockey arena is when Garth Brooks sings in the Target Center, we get revenue from it. $50,000 a day he paid back to us, the people, for the use of that building. If he were to go to the New River Center, that money would go to the hockey team. Garth Brooks' rent would go to the hockey team. Now, I'm interested to see Mr. Humphrey saying no, 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 yet Mr. Moe, if I recollect right, flew around the state in support of a stadium. He was on that little plane that went around all over and told everybody, yes, we want a stadium. I assume you got him in line. Is that what you did?
Well, I guarantee you, he's in line, but I have to tell you what happened.
Well, wait, okay, it's my turn right
okay.
now. I'm telling you unequivocally no. When Mike Piazza signs for $91 million for 7 years, they can build their own damn stadium.
You know, if I could just add one thing. You got to ask what's driving this. Is it the people demanding a new stadium? No. It's the industry.
All right.
And we've got to turn that around. That's why I'm investigating the baseball industry and the others, and we're going to get to the bottom line of it.
Crookston, go ahead with the question. Thanks.
In regards to the sports stadium issues, people in northern Minnesota often feel pretty helpless about what goes on in making those decisions.
I can hear the audio back there.
It's tough to hear that question.
We're having
a little bit of some technical difficulties.
Yeah. You wanted to continue on the sports.
Let me just mention. You've got to look at it just like you do in your family. You know, what are the priorities that you set out? I don't know about the others, but I'll tell you. First of all, I want to make sure I got a roof over my family's head. I want to make sure that we've got jobs that take care of them, that we make sure that there's good health and a decent education. After we take care of those things, then we figure out whether we go to the movies or the baseball game. The wrong priority is to say, you know, stadiums first, everything else second.
Let me throw something in, ladies and gentlemen. Look at campaign finances. Jesse Ventura has taken no money from major sports team owners in this city. The Republicans and Democrats both have major contributors of sports team owners. You be the judge on who's going to get a new stadium. That stadium we have is only 16 years old right now. Do we replace a school after 16 years? Absolutely not.
Let me jump in first, Jesse. The city of St. Paul gets $6 million a year in rent. And Skip, by the way, you're dead wrong. We went to the legislature the year before we got the $65 million, asked for a loan, and Roger Moe and Sandy Pappas killed it on the last day of the legislative session. So that's what we asked for right away. Skip, you're dead wrong. You're dead wrong on that loan. Let me respond. And what as an urban mayor who understands about economic development,
quickly.
When I took office as mayor of St. Paul, the value of taxable property was $300 million. 8 years earlier, it was $680 million. And what we've done, using, by the way, bringing in a private business that has taken a $20 million obligation, an old facility that we would have had to renovate, we've taken that off the books. We have now a new arena. We have a new convention center, a new science museum. We've got almost 4 million more people who'll be visiting the downtown in a couple of years.
They're
That's called economic development.
And all hundreds of millions of dollars of new debt public.
We have folks waiting for us at Lucille's Kitchen in North Minneapolis. Go ahead with your question, please.
I'm Mahmoud El-Qadi, and I have a rather theological question for the gentleman. It's theological in the sense that it's like religion, it simply will not go away. And it's concerning the president's initiative on race. I noticed that we talk about education, welfare, crime. Almost any issue you mention is crossed by that fundamental historical question, a question that has scarred the face of democracy since its inception. It has been the most vexing, troublesome side of our national life, past and present. My question is, why is it so difficult for us to discuss this reality, inescapable reality?
Okay.
We either trivialize it or we treat it as if it's so unspeakable and such bad taste that we can't discuss it. I have a specific reference to Well, I have a question. I want you to address that.
Okay, question of racism.
We have a presidential initiative. Wait, just a moment.
Okay, go ahead.
Speaking specifically to Norm Coleman, and last November, this is the classic example of what I'm talking about, at a conference at Hamline University, which was entitled A Dialogue on Race, Campus and Community, which he was the keynote speaker, and the first thing that came out of his mouth is that I don't like to talk about race, and that was the subject.
All right. Okay.
What's going on here?
You have a
president with enough courage to put it on the table, and you're backing off of this question, which this country cannot escape.
All right.
It's as visceral as apple pie in baseball.
Well, let him talk.
Thank you.
Mayor?
I think I was actually responding to your question in a very honest way, saying what you just said. When I said, I don't like to talk about it, I don't think I phrased that. I said, we as a community don't like to talk about that. We don't deal with it enough. I was, in fact, reflecting, I think, some of your concerns, but then I went on to say, talk about how do we deal with it. And part of the issue, the way we do it, there is an economic component to it. There is an economic component. It gets back to jobs and jobs opportunity for all our citizens and all our communities. And so I have been very, very aggressive on that issue, and particularly in the area of economic opportunity, working with the abundance of new jobs in St. Paul and the construction industry, working with women, working with minorities. So my reflection was a personal reflection, saying that we as a community do have trouble speaking about. I was at the conference. I was the keynote speaker. And I think reflecting the reality that this is a difficult issue to talk about. As a community, we have to do a better job.
I think we got to speak bluntly about the fact that there is racism. And if you want to talk about jobs, that's fine. But the premise of jobs is a well-trained, well-educated person that can obtain that job. And the key to breaking out of the problems of poverty and racism is the fullest opportunity of educational opportunity, of decent health care, of having decent housing, so that you can live a positive life and you can gain that center in yourself that allows you to succeed. I think Jesse speaks well about the personal confidence you must need to have in order to succeed. But you need to also have that full opportunity provided, and that is the responsibility of your state government, ladies and gentlemen, is to see that we have a quality education system, to see that we have the kind of health care that everyone can afford. So that's critical, and that will allow us to then speak very directly to the problems of racism. And by the way, I don't think we need to roll back the human rights amendments, as the mayor has recommended. We need to move forward beyond the law and into the kind of living that brings us together rather than separating us out.
Jesse Ventura.
Let's also remember something very clearly. When one of us comes forward and takes the gutsy stance and brings up a topic, look what happened to Jesse Ventura when he brought up the fact of dealing with prostitution and dealing with drugs. The media tried to crucify me. The media took things out of context and they waylaid me. I don't have a problem talking race. I've served in the military with every race, creed, and color. I coach football. I have kids of every race, creed, and color that I work with on a day-to-day basis. But the point is, we have to learn, too, that the media can be the culprit in this also. They can take things out of context. They can put a spin on it because they carry a political agenda, which is exactly what happened to me when I brought up the subject of prostitution. And the point I was making about it, sir, was that where is it always? It's down in the lower income places. They're the places that have to deal with it all the time.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Tonight's final major topic area is a concern that is really all across the state, and that is of crime. Paul Gustad of Duluth thinks about it both at home and at work.
A new movement called Restorative Justice focuses on the victims of crime. Just as a public defender protects the rights of the accused, Paul Gustad, Director of Victim Services in St. Louis County, protects victims' rights.
Historically, victims and witnesses have not been a part of the system. What we are saying is that if the criminal justice system is going to be successful, the victim and the witness have to be an integral part of the criminal justice system.
Paul may help victims get financial assistance, help them understand the courtroom process, or mediate between offenders and victims seeking restitution.
I think within the next decade, we will see victims' rights in the United States Constitution, and I think we'll see it in most states in the United States.
Restorative justice tries to redress the imbalances of the criminal justice system, and victims' rights are a key step towards community-based justice.
Oh, hi.
Don't lean in.
Got it? Don't lean in, just talk, okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Duluth.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Jan Jonasson. The tendency towards crime starts early. Studies have shown that kids who start smoking cigarettes often progress on to drugs. The public health community has recommended that 11% of the tobacco money be used to fund broad-based tobacco control programs based on prevention. Can you discuss the possibility of using this 11% of the tobacco money for the purpose of a smoke-free future for our kids?
I want to start Norm Coleman with that first in England, General Humphrey.
Two things first. One, that we are spending $200 million of the tobacco money on smoking cessation. I strongly support that. But beyond that, I don't think that we commit X percent of the dollars to this program or that program. In fact, what I would like to say, what I've done is I've taken some of that tobacco money and have cut taxes, and then you give parents, to get back to parents, let them make the choices rather than setting up more government programs. The fact is, I would trust them then to make that judgment and work with their kids. Strongly support smoking cessation efforts, support the $200 million, but we don't need to take X percent, 11%, and say we're going to set it aside for the creation of more programs.
Well, I couldn't disagree more, folks. This is not a government program. The $200 million that the mayor talks about is the first installment of a total of just about 11%. I mean, what was that lawsuit all about? It was about getting restorative justice, which is what the conversation was before. It's about returning the costs of harm and danger and death that this industry has caused to people. What we need to do is continue over a five-year period to fully fund a nonprofit, independent organization that will provide world-class leadership emanating from Minnesota, new jobs, new opportunities based upon what the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and so many others are doing, along with C. Everett Koop. This is the opportunity of a lifetime to get it right. You'll not only provide good opportunities in the future for better initiatives to stop smoking, but guess what, folks? You will give life. Years and years, decades of new life to the next generation that is smoke-free, and Minnesota's going to be first if I have anything to do about it.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's talk about that money. It didn't hurt the tobacco companies one bit. All this money that's coming in didn't hurt tobacco at all. Why? They simply raised the price. It was 2.5 cents per pack to cover the Minnesota settlement. Tobacco companies actually raised the price a nickel. So whose money is this? This is simply the very addicted smoker having to pay more, and so it's really and truly, it didn't hurt the tobacco companies. It's just smokers having to pay more tax.
And Schiff said I was stealing government's money by giving it back to people. It's the people's money.
Well, it is the people's money.
Me, I thought it was my turn.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Well, just don't distort the facts.
I'm not distorting the facts.
Oh, no, you're not.
It's lumped right onto the very addicted smoker is paying the bill, not the tobacco companies. They actually became more profitable because they raised the price a nickel.
This is the way, though, to get back at making sure that the marketplace changes.
The judicial system is what it is.
Place changes.
We have a question here in the studio audience. Karen Louise Booth from NPR, take it away.
I'm standing here with Sandra Coulson of Minneapolis. Sandra, what's your question?
My question is, how can you assist our communities in integrating all law enforcement agencies and activities into one cohesive, responsive unit? In other words, should there be a consolidation of law enforcement agencies?
We have 2 minutes for responses, so we'll start with Jesse Ventura. Go ahead.
That's a tough one. I was mayor of Brooklyn Park, and we had our own police department. I think that should be left up to the local jurisdictions and the local governments. If they want to combine police forces like Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, I think it should come from that end of government down on the local level rather than any mandating from up above.
General Humphrey?
You know, when I was growing up in the suburbs of Maryland, when my father was senator down there, I can tell you, I know what a state police force is all about. They don't have local jurisdictions. I believe in local police forces, but the key is coordination, making sure that we're working at the state level, the county level, the local level, and coordinating that with neighborhoods and neighborhood organizations. Once again, you got to come back to families and the communities. When you tie all that together, good communications, good training, the kind of cooperation between, you have a more powerful force than any single organization.
Okay. Mayor Coleman.
Strong local enforcement tied in with community-based policing. But I'll give you two very specifics where you can make improvement. One, you can make improvement in terms of communication. So that in the city of St. Paul, working with Ramsey County to have a single communication center. And then the second area that's very important is statewide enforcement, working with statewide gang units. Because gangs don't observe those geopolitical boundaries, we need to strengthen the statewide effort to fight gangs. Those two improvements will make a difference, but again, the base is quality local law enforcement.
I get the last question. You have 30 seconds each to answer it. Clearly, undecided people are going to decide this election. And this electorate, as you all know, because of the polls, is very fluid. So, Norm Coleman, give me your best 30 seconds to convince undecided voters why you should be governor.
Kathy, I've been endorsed by 17 major newspapers around the state of Minnesota, and I've been endorsed because I am the only person who has governed and delivered on the commitment to cut taxes, to promote job growth, greater opportunity, who's been an advocate for parental involvement and expansion of educational opportunity. I've done it, not just promises. So vote for the person who has delivered on the promise and can lead Minnesota into a brighter and more prosperous future.
General Humphrey.
Kathy, I believe in this state in my whole heart with the people of Minnesota. And I know that while it's a good state the way it is, we can be so much better. We've taken on tough fights together. We've won for the people of Minnesota. But we now need to meet our commitments to our families. And we can do that by making sure that we're returning the tax dollars to working families, that we are providing the best public education system in the world for world-class schools, that we are taking care of our senior citizens as well as our young people with regard to their health. If we do that, we'll make this state not only good, we'll make it the best.
Jesse Ventura.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I think they should vote for me because I'm a breath of fresh air. I'm not a career politician. I'm not somebody who's going to do this job years and years or has done it years and years before. But let me add, I too have governed. I've been the mayor of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. And I would tell people, I come with no strings attached. There's no special interest money involved with me. I haven't accepted any PAC money. So when Jesse Ventura goes over there, he can do what's best for Minnesota. And also, I come with no partisan party politics that what we're seeing today of gridlock, fighting between the Democrats and Republicans. That won't happen with Jesse Ventura over there for more than one reason. Not only do I not belong to those parties, but I'm Jesse Ventura.
Thanks to the candidates, Jesse Ventura, Skip Humphrey, and Norm Coleman.
Thank you.
Thanks also to the citizens, and thanks to you for watching as well. But the evening isn't entirely over. No, if you are watching or listening to us live Friday night, you're in luck. The citizens will hang around for another hour to debate the debate and talk issues. That program starts in about 2 minutes on KTCI Channel 17 or on your local Minnesota Public Radio station. Lori Sturdivant with the Star Tribune and Karen Louise Booth of NPR will be the moderators, starting in just about 2 minutes.
And if you need any more information about Tuesday's election, you can go to the KTCA election website, www.ktca.org. You'll find everything you need right there and some things you don't need but are just kind of fun. www.ktca.org. And a quick word of thanks to the Otto Bremer Foundation and the PBS Democracy Project for their support in making tonight's event happen. For all of us here at KTCA, the Star Tribune, NPR, KMOJ Radio, and Insight News, as well as Internews Interactive, you be careful. Good night. Good luck to all.
And stay with us. As Kathy Worcester said, there's much more to come in the second half of our program tonight. Lori Sturdivant and Karen Louise Booth of the Star Tribune and of NPR, respectively, moderating the second half of the program, talking about the candidates tonight. Secretary of State Joan Groh says slightly more than half of eligible Minnesotans will vote Tuesday. That would be similar to participation in the gubernatorial election of 1994, when a U.S. Senate seat was on the ballot. Groh says she thinks interest in the governor's race is increasing as Election Day nears. She predicts a turnout of about 53%, or just under 1.85 million voters. Groh says Reform Party gubernatorial candidate Jesse Ventura may attract some Minnesotans who haven't voted recently. She says interest in the three proposed constitutional amendments and close local races may also help. Polls show a tight race as the major party candidates for governor head into this final weekend of campaigning. Republican Norm Coleman plans to travel in southeastern Minnesota today. DFLer Skip Humphrey and Reform Party candidate Jesse Ventura are in the Twin Cities in central Minnesota, and polls show Humphrey and Coleman in a dead heat, with Ventura coming on strong going into this final debate tonight. Today's programming is made possible in part by the advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include Cargill, supporting Minnesota's tradition of community service, and Norwest Foundation on behalf of Norwest Investment Management and Trust. Following the second half of our debate program tonight, we'll be hearing from the other candidates for governor, giving them a chance to comment, and that'll be from 9:30 to 10 o'clock tonight. And from 10 to 11, as usual, As It Happens from the CBC, and News Overnight from the BBC, beginning at 11 o'clock.
That's what they just heard. And so also can tell us some of the things they wish they would have had a chance to get to tonight. We have a number of citizens who had questions prepared, but no time to ask them. So Karen Louise, we've got one such citizen in mind right here.
Bob, why don't you stand up? Your name and where you live.
I'm Bob Galaski from Brooklyn Park. And the fellow from Crookston had a question. I think it was the same as the one that I was wondering about. He got kind of technically garbled, so I'll ask it again. I think we're concerned as citizens about input for a sports stadium that we sort of feel powerless and not listened to sometimes. Public opinion in the past has been very negative on this issue, and I was wondering if the candidates would support public funding of professional sporting facilities without a statewide referendum. And I'm just curious of why Norm Coleman in particular kind of overlooked that issue.
It is something that the candidates haven't maybe talked about as much as we thought they might when we first did our Minnesota poll back in February to identify the five top issues that were on Minnesotans' mind as they started this gubernatorial campaign. But we did get in a few comments tonight about the stadium issue. What did some of the rest of you think about what you heard tonight on that question? Chuck, did you have a comment about that?
Well, I'm Chuck Simpkins from Cannon Falls, and I believe that in a certain sense Norm Coleman is correct that if you can have economic growth in an area, revitalize an area, the state is involved in funding and subsidizing many corporations and companies here. And if you can, through user fees, build a stadium that will only tax the people who want to go to the game, I think we should be given that choice. It's government's responsibility to facilitate these kind of things, and if it's not going to hurt anybody else but the people who want to go see the game, I think they should be given that option.
The gentleman who got cut off up in Crookston might be standing by up there now with, I hope, a better audio link so we can hear him. And let me just say, one of the opportunities that we have through the wonders of technology tonight is to be able to have citizens groups in four locations where people can actually talk one to another. So let's get the Crookston people involved in this conversation. Hi.
Hi. I'm Lane Leslie from Warren.
You can hear much better now, Lane.
Okay, good. Yeah, our concern is of course, it was touched on a little bit by when the other gentleman talked about it. We're concerned that we rarely get heard in this area, and feel rather helpless. I don't think the candidates did address it at all as far as who makes the decisions about the issues like this, the sports stadium. And I think it would be a good thing if we could have a statewide vote on something like that, but we do feel like we're ignored to a large degree up here.
There are several other people I know who had questions that went unanswered tonight, and we have one more such person here in the state fire audience. I'll go next to Duluth and then to Lucille.
I'm here with Gordon Hovde of Albert Lea, and one of the things that reporters always say during campaigns is watch the numbers or follow the numbers. And we've heard the candidates all campaign season long talk about spending or tax breaks or what they would put in their budgets or not put in their budgets. What's your question or your observation?
My question has to do, throughout the campaign, we've lost sight of the budget itself. The budget's grown 20% in the last 2 years, and that has not been a campaign issue. I mean, all we're talking about is a surplus. Well, the reason we're so heavily taxed is the 20% increase in the last 2 years, which has gone on before that. Our budget has gone up enormously, and already we're talking about additional programs. I wish that we had brought this out better, not just concentrated on the surplus, but concentrated on what's happened to the budget itself.
Okay, that's an interesting comment. Anybody, Duluth, want to get in on the conversation here? What did you hope to ask tonight and didn't get a chance to? What did you hope to hear that you didn't?
Well, this is Jim Newman here in Duluth, and standing by is Lucas May from Deerwood. He wanted to ask a question about crime.
Yes, I was wondering what was going to be done about to address the issue of crime and violence in our public school system. It's been pretty prevalent lately, and
we seem to be having just a little audio difficulty here, but the comment was about crime, and we haven't heard as much about that issue in this campaign as you'd like to. Am I getting the sense of your question?
Yeah, addressing crime in the public schools.
Crime in public schools.
Yeah. I was wondering how that would be treated by the candidates.
It's another topic we haven't heard a lot about, but something I know that's of concern to a lot of parents in the metropolitan area and elsewhere. And how about at Lucille's? What were some of the concerns there that you wish you would have heard more of tonight?
The concern that I have is a follow-up to the question dealing with racism and race, and particularly racial bias crimes. I think one of the things that we've definitely seen with the growing population of Ethiopians, Somalians, and others in our state, particularly in the outstate, Rochester, St. Cloud, Duluth, and areas like that, what we want to know is how are these situations going to be addressed. Among those situations of late have been the situation where the young man was harassed, I think because he was going with a Caucasian young lady. The other situations kind of dealing with physical assault on immigrants in greater Minnesota. And these concerns are continuing to grow. There was a hate crimes conference that was recently held. Our concern is how are we going to begin to deal with a growing and diverse Minnesota in terms of making people welcome and feel like they can contribute here.
We didn't catch your name, so I'd like you to stay there at the microphone and continue a conversation about that topic. What is your name?
My name is Lester Collins. I'm the director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans.
I wonder what ideas you might have to bring the issue of hate crimes, hate and racial hatred, other kinds of societal problems along that line, more to bear, more to leading towards some resolution. What would you have liked to have heard in this whole campaign that you haven't?
Well, number one, direct leadership, listening to the community. We've been holding forums in St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester. Folk are wanting to know if legislators are concerned, what are they going to do in terms of helping those areas kind of begin to resolve and deal with those problems themselves. In terms of solutions, certainly we feel that we have written to each one of the candidates kind of pointing out solutions and recommendations that we have. Here in Minneapolis, in terms of the whole Code 4 kinds of things, the gang strike task force, we're asking for parents to be notified. We're asking for some racial statistics to be kept. We're also asking to know, you know, who is actually being arrested in these in terms of the gang strike task force kinds of issues. So
let's continue with our wrap-up on what we wish we would have heard more of tonight in tonight's debate and in this whole campaign. Karen Louise has got someone here ready to give us a thought.
Well, I'm actually here sitting in the audience with Gary Anderson of Lakeville. And, Gary, I know your question is on education. In fact, poll after poll has told us that education is if not the one of the top two issues on the minds of voters in this year's midterm election. Do you feel the candidates had time to resolve their discussion about educational issues for you?
No, I don't think they did. I've been waiting for a full 6 weeks to hear a clear vision about what this number one issue is and what they stand for. And even tonight I hear a lot of one-liners, I hear a lot of indirect comments, a lot of almost platitudinal statements, but really not a clear vision that would talk about what we really need to do to get ready for the next millennium, to get people ready for what will be a very, very difficult time unless we're prepared educationally. And I think they've really skirted the issue, and I was hoping that to be more direct tonight, and I just did not hear that.
Karen Louise, I'd like you to join me here. We have an opportunity for those of us who have been hosted this evening and who have worked through this process for a number of months to give our reactions for a few minutes and kind of kick off the rest of our conversation tonight with the citizens as we finish talking about this entire campaign and the process we've been through. And I'll pick up on what Gary just had to say to begin. My impression is that we give a lot of lip service to education, but the education issue hasn't really come through as a number one issue in this campaign. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think with the surveys, I mean, people try to intersect national politics and what's going on at the national level with what dominates local discussion. I think that's where the whole character thing, the whole issue of character of candidates came in on the polls of recent. Of course, we have to look at the medium, and it's an opportunity for candidates to speak to issues, but some of the one-liners are because the message is the medium, and we're on a very tight program schedule here. So that's where you have to look and fill in between the lines and read the newspapers and read magazines and take in all of it on radio and television. But I think that this is where voters feel disengaged, is because they have less access to the media and asking the questions, driving the agenda, and in many ways less access to candidates who are predisposed to working the press.
It seems like there's been a fog this year that's been hard to penetrate, and part of that fog, of course, has been coming from Washington with all the news dominance there. We have Dan Gustafson, your Gunderson, I'm saying your name wrong, Dan, I apologize, your colleague in public radio up at Crookston, who's ready to join in this conversation. Hi, Dan.
Oh, well, you know, the debate here, most of the people who came here had their minds made up on who they were going to vote for, and nobody had their mind changed by this debate. And one of the comments that quite a few people mentioned was that they didn't hear anything new in this debate. They heard the same rhetoric they've been hearing from the candidates now for a number of weeks. So there was no real enlightenment in the debate.
Now, we've had more debates this campaign than I can remember, and certainly through the summer in the DFL primary, more debates. I think the Humphrey campaign once tied up that there would have been something like 40 joint candidate appearances for their candidate from beginning of this year through November 3rd. That's I've got to be a record. But I wonder if Minnesotans feel more enlightened having had that many debates.
Well, I think that everything that we know about citizens, I mean, we're all citizens. We have lives. Most of us do. And, you know, we're very busy through the summer. We're at the cabin. We're fishing. We're getting the house painted. Most people just simply don't have the time to devote to sifting through all of the rhetoric, and that certainly is part of our job and certainly part of the reasons why events like this are held and conducted. And hopefully it sheds light. But it really takes an involved electorate to really begin to do some of the heavy lifting themselves, to sift through and make their decisions by next Tuesday.
I think you're right. Ruthie Zulu of KMOJ Radio. Hi, Ruthie.
Hey, how are you doing? What are
your thoughts about some of the issues we're talking about tonight?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of things. And then with the comment that was just made about going to the cabin and the fishing, it brought out a real loud degree of laughter here for folks who say who do not have cabins and did not get a chance to deal with going fishing. And indeed, I think that the folks over here at Lucille's Kitchen were a bit disengaged as a result of the fact that the candidates seemed to be dancing around an awful lot of times. They found more excuses than they did actual responses. And it still appeared that there were those who were looking for quick answers. They had real quick answers to an awful lot of things that were being raised. I mean, they were pat answers, and they did not really address the questions which were being raised. I'm talking about the candidates. I don't think that the candidates were really speaking to the people. They were speaking at the people more than to or with the folks.
Interesting perspective. And we haven't heard yet from Jim Newman in Duluth. Jim, would you like to get in on this?
Yes, I certainly would, and we're developing a theme here. The folks here in Duluth agree with folks in Crookston, Lucille's Kitchen, and to a certain extent in St. Paul. They really didn't learn that much new. Also, quite disappointed that candidates, again, in their mind, refused to get into the specifics and rather took the easy road into a kind of rhetoric that many of us have heard before. A comment that I would make is that it seems as we're getting close to the election, that particularly Mr. Coleman and Mr. Humphrey are, I wouldn't say necessarily pandering, but they're catering to their political base. And that may be effective for their campaign managers, but it doesn't seem to do a whole lot for Mr. and Mrs. Greater Minnesota. As for Jesse Ventura, we appreciate the one-liners, but we're not sure that we want a comedian as governor.
Well, we had another comedian on the involved in tonight. Minor party candidate Fancy Bacconi was also a participant via the Lucille's Kitchen group tonight. Well, I think that raises another whole issue that probably is fodder for discussion at Lucille's Kitchen and here too, in all of our neighborhoods, and that is, who has access? If we want change in public policy, we have to look at who's running for public office. And we need more people of color. We need more women gaining office. And I think when we look at diversity in government, that's part of where the answers might lie in the future. Let's go back to Boozy.
Yeah, well, I'm still here. And I think that the whole concept of having more diversity in terms of who's running for office has to begin with, first of all, folks believing that politicians aren't the lower-than-wheel excrement. It has to be that, indeed, that politicians are valuable servants of the people and for the people. Now, without that, and without folks going around saying that politicians are always bad media, we have been a party to that process. But there have been others who have been going around talking about all the politicians are bad, who were politicians themselves. So in order to get people of color to do this act of running for public office, it has to be that it is something that is valuable and it is valued. If it is not valued, then of course we won't get involved in it, other than to say that it's a bunch of other folks who are doing the wrong things. And so I think that we have a number of folks who have been very, very political in our communities, continue to be. But that's where our real politics takes place. It's in our communities. And we're trying to get other folks to understand that it works in the best interest of us when we are working together.
I'd be curious to know what the voter turnout is in the metro and in the outstate. I mean, during the primary, we expected lower than ever turnout predicted. This is a midterm election, but this race, of course, is getting more interesting. So I think come Wednesday morning, there will be a lot of discussion.
Joan Glow's predictions today, I think, were for about a 52 to 54% turnout, which would be among the biggest turnouts in the nation, but wouldn't be a record for Minnesota by any means. In fact, I think that's quite very much like what we had 4 years ago. Dan Gunderson, what do you think about the turnout issue and whether this race has excited the people of the northwestern Minnesota area?
I think it has excited them. I think Jesse Ventura's campaign has drawn a lot of attention to the race. People have called in and said they're making their own signs for Jesse Ventura, and they're excited. People who haven't been involved in the process before are excited about this race, but I think in many rural areas there's a lot of local issues that draw voters out as well, and I think that's probably key to the voter turnout in many communities.
I think it was Jim Newman who said a moment ago that the candidates seem to be hunkering down and appealing to their bases, which is what I think you do when the election is as close as the polls say this one is going to be. But Jesse Ventura really doesn't have a defined base. The Reform Party is something that's sort of being made up as we go along.
He may not have a defined geographic base, but I'm interested in knowing what the homogeneity is of the Jesse Ventura camp, if you will. I mean, I don't think we've really looked at who is it that Jesse appeals to. I think we could draw some generalizations about the socioeconomic base and not a geographic per se, but I think that he really has infused a lot of energy into the whole campaign and has given this nation something to think about in terms of third party development.
I'd like to expand the conversation now to get the citizens back involved. We had several people tonight, five to be exact, one for each of our featured issues, people who were profiled give the issue special attention. We have we've started with taxes because that seems to be the issue that Minnesotans most eagerly talk about whenever state politics is discussed, and we had Rob Nelson from Winnebago as the profiled citizen. Rob, I wonder what you thought of that, the discussion of taxes that you heard tonight, whether it answered the questions that you brought to this debate.
I thought as far as the tax issue, I thought that all three of the candidates did compared to the other issues, did a pretty good job of trying to explain the tax issue.
You're satisfied with the, as you would compare the three candidates with their proposals, do you have a favorite?
I like to see the candidates talk more about the issues rather than talk about each other and each other's plan. And, Norm and Skip can go back and forth, but and talk about each other. But when Jesse talks about himself and what he's going to do, rather than what everyone else has done or is going to do.
Thank you very much. I understand that Carolyn in Crookston is ready to share her reactions to what she heard tonight. Her issue tonight was welfare and poverty and the farm issue, the farm crisis.
Yes, it was. And the question that I asked was answered by all three of the candidates, and I guess there weren't any new things presented as far as a plan or a solution, and I guess I have been decided as to who my candidate was, and I was impressed with what he had to say. What really impressed me tonight was that tonight Minnesota became a neighborhood rather than just a state, and we were able to all get together, and I go to the University of Minnesota here in Crookston, and it's got a lot of technology in our curriculum, and we all have our own laptop, and it's amazing to watch the whole state get together and have a debate at the same time, or to witness a debate and be a part of that. So that was the thing that impressed me the most about this evening.
Well, thank you for that, Carolyn, and I'm wondering what you would like to see done about the deepening farm crisis as soon as the next governor, whomever he may be, is in office.
Well, now, that's a loaded question. I'm not sure that there's anything that a governor can do about prices, but I think that he can be visible in Washington, and that is where a lot of the problem lies in the farm economy. But there are things that go beyond that, living in rural Minnesota. Things like take, for instance, telephone service. You know, up here in our economy, it costs to dial 40 miles from home, or 20 miles from home, is a long-distance call, wherein in the Twin Cities area, you can maybe dial 40 within a 40-mile proximity. So it's difficult economically up here in more ways than one. And so transitioning from agriculture to another occupation or career is very possible. I mean, we have the University of Minnesota up here in Crookston, and I can't say enough good things about that. It has been a very useful resource for me, and I've used it, and I will graduate this spring with a baccalaureate degree. I don't think it's a hopeless situation, but I do believe that there is a lot of attention and a lot of creativity that needs to be used, and you know, it's a big problem. It's a complex problem, and there's not a magic wand that can be waved to say, okay, now the farm crisis is over, and here's the solution. It didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to get solved overnight.
Thank you for those comments, Carolyn. Phil Nuncio here in St. Paul helped us understand the stadium issue a little better with his question tonight. What did you think of what you heard?
Well, I thought they were quite different in each one of their answers. I got the idea from Jesse that there would not be any subsidy for any public stadium, and the same thing with Mr. Humphrey obviously has Mr. Moe in tow. I sort of got the drift from Mr. Coleman, and I sort of understand his issue. St. Paul has been like the small twin sister. $85 million was put in to improve the convention center in Minneapolis. Minneapolis keeps getting stronger and more money and so on and so forth, and their economic base keeps growing and growing, and I think Coleman possibly wanted to do that with obtaining at least one of the four franchises to St. Paul, and that may have been an issue there, and that may be, if that's the way that they take a look at it, may be okay in that, but not a 15-year-old stadium. In 15 years when the Wild decide they can't make any money with it, they shouldn't subsidize it anymore. And I also wanted to ask the question, the $85 million that went to Minneapolis Convention Center, is that for the Democratic Convention? I mean, what is it really? I've been there. It's a beautiful building. It's just a beautiful building. What are the $85 million to expand it for? And that's to use the tax dollars, too. Nothing to do with the stadium issue, but I would have liked to have asked that question, too.
Okay, up in Duluth, we also had a citizen who was involved, Paul Gustad. I wonder if Paul is on hand to share his reaction to what he heard. Nope, I'm told he's not. How about it, Lucille's?
Go ahead.
Yep. Lucille's says, go ahead.
Yes, good evening. I'm Dr. Willie Williams, educator with the Minneapolis Public Schools. My question is this. Last year, it was revealed that nearly 91% of African-American students in grades 8 in the Minneapolis schools failed to pass the Minnesota State Standards Test. Thus, we have the current NAACP suit for more state equity in education. My question for each of the candidates, where do you stand on this particular issue? Do you have a solution for this very pressing problem? I would appreciate your answer. Thank you very much.
Well, and I gather since the candidates have gone, I gather that your sense is you haven't heard enough about that in this campaign. I wonder if many Minnesotans are aware of how pressing that lawsuit is and how that will become an issue in 1999. It's certainly something for people to be aware of. I understand someone's standing by in Crookston to join in this conversation. Hi.
Hello there. My name is Mary Nell Chrysler, and I wanted to address further the farm crisis. I am a farm crisis worker. I am a mediator and an outreach worker that works with farm families and creditors. At a report that was given out to the Senate hearing in Thief River Falls October 16th, this is a preliminary report that projected that 60% of the farmers in northwestern Minnesota are not going to be able to pay their 1998 operating expense, and they're not going to pay their long-term debts off. This will include the taxes that they're not going to ask to be paid in the first place. They're not going to be paid for 60% of our farmers. I'd like to know what they're going to do besides the tax relief. And to follow up on Carolyn's, yes, we can have state relief as far as they will take it to Washington, D.C. and get federal relief also. But our state is going to have to push harder to find some sort of a way to keep at least 60% of our farm families out of bankruptcy or from leaving the farms. Who's going to be farming the farms?
So you're thinking that there needs to be a good deal more state, at least attention to this problem, it sounds like.
I'm very disappointed that we did not even cover that really tonight. Okay. We had a short video clip about it. When we have projections like this from very hard numbers, and then we don't even really address the issue, we have a promise of our projected promise of tax relief. Doesn't make any difference. They weren't going to pay the taxes anyway.
Thank you for those comments. We have someone here in the studio audience ready to join in.
I'm standing here with Phil Parsons of Northfield. What's your question about the economy? And you come from Northfield. It's wonderful, wonderful community, by the way. But it's still very much almost metro in a way because it's so close. But we often hear politicians saying that strength in the cities means strength in greater Minnesota. But what have you or haven't you heard along those lines?
Well, first of all, indeed, my area is becoming exurban very rapidly, but that's not the case in southwest or in northwest Minnesota. Because I work in an agricultural business, we have some experience with the enlarging of farms. We know that there are really difficult times on many of those farms, and they aren't going to be resolved with a quick fix. But one of my questions would have been, what could have been done to support and enhance the small towns and rural areas now that this farm size has increased and that these kinds of difficulties come to farmers? It seems to me that many of those people will leave the farms and come to increase the problems in the urban areas, where we ought to work for ways to keep them in those communities and strengthen them so they become enlarged and more capable.
That's a great comment, particularly what we hear in northeast Minneapolis and north Minneapolis. I've been to Lucille's Kitchen talking about strengthening the neighborhoods, strengthening the communities, getting stores in neighborhoods so that people don't have to travel outside of their neighborhood to have access to shopping and other services. And Phil raises a really good point. Let's strengthen the inner core, but also let's talk about strengthening the state's health economy as well. And I'm wondering what other people here have to say about that.
We have someone else who wants it in the conversation. Let me just say that we're lucky tonight to have with us not only Citizens Forum participants from this year, but some of the class of 1997 and 1996 as well. And I'm going to say your name wrong, so I'm going to let you say it, but this is a class of 1996 participant. Hi.
Yes, this is Ed Kekai. I'm from Glenwood, Minnesota. The area that I wish that the
would have heard the government of candidates address would be the Union Compact. And what I'm relating to there is I have no objection to the gambling casinos, but I would like to see what could be done where some of those benefits would accrue to the entire state of Minnesota rather than just to one group.
Thank you. That's, again, something we've heard relatively little about, though I think in one earlier debate, Norm and Skip tangled on that one. But it's another person here wants in. Hi.
Hi, my name is Todd Franz. I guess I'd like to talk about accountability and trust, and I just would like to know if the candidates would be accountable and how they would guarantee that to us so we don't have another Clinton mess. I'd like to see these people hold true to what they said to me.
You're talking about accountability personally or on the issues? Say a little more about that.
Well, I think on both, actually. I think they both, all of them talked about their personal lives and how they felt their family was important to them. But I'm just wondering if that'll be holding true in the future, and we'll see that. And also, when they talk about something, can they really do it? First of all, is it worth their effort to talk about it? Do they have a real decision-making input in what they're saying? Can they do what they say, or are they just telling us something we want to hear so we'll vote for them?